Hi, my name is Jamie Love. I work for an NGO in Washington, D.C. called CP Tech. And I'm going to talk about the social movement to make medicines public goods. The first story I will talk about concerns the campaign for people to have access to medicine. This is a slide about a campaign in Thailand in 1998 to get access to a drug called fluconazole, which then cost 200 baht in the Thai currency per pill. And it was used to treat cryptococcal meningitis, which about 10% of the late stage AIDS patients in Thailand had. It was a brain fungus that was very painful and led to blindness and to death. After the NGOs mounted a campaign in Thailand to remove the monopoly on the drug, it was available for 6.5 baht per pill. And it went from having no access for the treatment of cryptococcal meningitis to having universal access for cryptococcal meningitis. It was the model for all subsequent campaigns on AIDS drugs, was to introduce competition to drive prices closer to manufacturing cost. The gentleman in the yellow shirt was active in several of these campaigns. I showed this slide in one meeting. A woman came up. She knew the gentleman in the slide, and he's dead now. And that's the point of this campaign, is as though people don't have to die. They don't have access to medicine. These are slides from the campaign in South Africa over pricing of AIDS drug. When I started working on this campaign, in South Africa, the price of the cheapest cocktail for AIDS was $10,000. Last summer, 2 years after the 2001 trial, the price was, in the private sector, still $2,000. I worked for the Competition Commission in South Africa last summer, and Glaxo and Boehringer were found guilty of excessive pricing and refusals to license their patents, and the government ordered them to issue license to generic drug companies. It's now possible to get those cocktails for around $200 per year. This is a submission by Gleevec, a Swiss company, to Korea on the price that Norvadis charges in the United States, Switzerland, Germany, the UK, Japan, France, and Italy for a drug for leukemia. It's around $160 per day for some doses. Now, why would Korea be told by a drug company the prices that are charged in those countries? It's because the European Commission negotiated a trade agreement with Korea to force Korea to charge at least the minimum prices, the average prices in those seven countries, the so-called A7 pricing agreement. We thought this was an American trade agreement. We were in a meeting with the Europeans, and the Americans were complaining about the Americans, as usual. And then the Europeans interjected, and they said, "That's our agreement. We're very proud of it." So, trade pressure's all over the place. This is patients getting removed from the Norvadis headquarters by police when they were protesting the price of that leukemia drug. So, there's an issue, and that is, how do you promote access to medicine for all? Is it possible to have marginal cost pricing for the poor? And one question is, will it coexist? Can you have high prices in Europe and America and cheap prices elsewhere? That's actually an interesting question. And is the right to health related to the right to copy technologies? This is a slide on efficiency. This is what the data suggest when you buy a drug, what fraction of the dollar goes to different things. About 3% goes to the cost of manufacturing and distributing the drugs in an efficient manner. About 3% spent on R&D on old products. About 8% is spent on R&D on drugs that are new but not better than existing products. And about 2% on products which are both new and better than existing products. And about 0 is spent on drugs that affect people who are primarily poor, like malaria. And about 84% goes on something else. That's basically our brilliant mechanism for financing R&D. This is how it works. And we're engaging all sorts of creative mechanisms, too, for encouraging rational use of medicines. This is, by far and away, the most extensive role for the big pharma companies. When Tim and I talked to Aventis, we asked them how many employees they had, and I think they said 76,000. And so we said, how many develop new drugs? And they said 7,000. So we said, what do the other 69,000 people do? And they said, they sell the drugs. Now, our access and R&D competing policy objectives. Do we need a global framework for funding R&D? Yes, we need a new trade framework. As Tim mentioned, the current trade framework is the trade agreements about patents. So if you have strong patent policy, you meet all your international obligations. It makes no difference what your prices are. It makes no difference whether you do public sector financing. All you have to do is just have strong patent laws. But it's not a very thoughtful way to think about it. So the basic framework that Tim and I have worked on with other people, and now there's a growing social movement on this, is to benchmark a fraction of the GDP of every country. Initial thinking, 10 to 15 basis points, that has to be devoted to the support of research and development. And then to reward social priorities in the accounting system as to how you measure your contributions, and to have weights for priority research, public databases, openness, technology transfer, so that you drive investment through the weighting system at the global level toward areas that have the greatest global benefit. Recognizing the important public goods nature of research. It's a no free rider treaty. It's also a treaty about social priorities. Then we have this issue of global versus local, or centralization versus decentralization. Our fundamental structure for the treaty is you only make global the things that need to be global. You have standardization at the top in a very few areas, like, for example, how much GDP you spend to finance R&D. And your discussion about some of the weighting for driving money to things like malaria and things. But you allow countries to choose their own mechanisms for financing R&D. They can choose strong intellectual property rights, strong patent rights, or weak patent rights. Public sector financing or private sector financing, statist models or decentralized models. They're not told what to do. They're told that they have to spend, but they're given the freedom to choose different methods of implementing their obligation. Our preferred implementation is prices at marginal cost, openness in research, decentralized decision-making, competition, competitive structures, things that reward risk-taking and success, and a role for both profit and non-profit organizations. Believe me, every time we start off with this, we're informed about the failed Soviet Union experience in 1917. And so we, from the very, very beginning, this has always been something. When you remove willing buyer, willing seller models and you replace it with some other model, you have to think hard about all things that can go wrong. So the R&D treaty idea, these are some Venn diagrams, they can be implemented with or without intellectual property protection. You can have the R&D treaty, You can also have IPR treaties. It depends, even at the national level. And the R&D treaty can be implemented with or without marginal cost pricing. And you can have marginal cost pricing with or without intellectual property protections. There's all sorts of different ways these things can be done. I won't explain them all, relax, but just to point out that we put so many ideas together, sometimes people think, they get the wrong impression sometimes of the flexibility. Now, this is a statement by the U.S. government to the WHO on October 30th of last year. It says the body should not be engaged in considering amendment to existing international trade or legal instruments, such as a new international research and development treaty. This was our first status symbol, the official opposition of the U.S. government to a treaty on research and development. We're very proud of this. And then this is a more recent document from the research-based pharmaceutical industry, the handful of companies whose brands you recognize. It says, this was to the UN Millennium Project, and they said, in particular, it would be a grave error to adopt recommendations urged by some industry critics for a new R&D treaty. And we're very flattered to be mentioned, even in the footnote, as one of the chief proponents of this. But unfortunately, they left out the G8, who apparently has joined our movement, because they made an announcement yesterday of this big international plan to organize global efforts to fund malaria vaccine based upon the Human Genome Project. So it's collaborative, it's decentralized, it's based on the Human Genome Project. They're getting scientists together to share information. We have to work fast because we're getting too close to the G8, so it's troublesome. Now, so paying for public goods, how do you do it? How do you actually pay the salaries of people that create public goods if you don't give all your money to Glaxo or to Merck or Pfizer? Here's the pull method. And first of all, let me just ask, how much time do I have? Because I don't want to abuse the time. I'm okay, all right. So the main idea is to create private markets for public goods. Now, how would we do that? Well, there's actually, turns out, quite a few different models, and I will only talk about the simplest pull model, which is the prize model. And here's the idea. You just put a huge amount of money up, and you say if you were successful in developing a new drug, we just give you money. We don't give you a 20-year marketing monopoly and then be shocked when the price of an AIDS drug or the price of a cancer drug is high and people can't afford it. Having seen that quite a few times in the past, if you're continuing to be shocked at those stories, it's an unwillingness to comprehend how the mechanism works. You give a monopoly for a life-saving drug, the better the drug, the more morally repugnant the outcome, basically. So, in the prize fund, you substitute the morally repugnant system of a monopoly on a drug with a cash incentive. It's winner take all. It's consistent with even having patents, exclusive rights, all kinds of normal problems, the current system, all the way through the registration of the drug. But after it is registered, it becomes a public good. So you can have 1,000 patents, you can have secrecy, you can have corruption and bribery, you can have all those good things up until the point it's registered, and then it becomes a public good. The values are not determined by willing buyer and willing seller. The U.S. version that is being considered now is 50 basis points of GDP, $57 billion a year, which is a lot of money. It's a huge amount of money, actually, for R&D. And the payoffs to the innovators who put the products on the market, and that would generate data on the use of the product, and that would generate claims against the $57 billion fund. And evidence of the benefits is the basis for claims in the fund. There's different models for, and really they're looking at all sorts of issues in the payoff system. But the main idea is to push money into where the incremental benefits are, so that if you have three versions of Viagra now, the new versions would maybe get some benefit over the old one, but they'd have to, you know, be considerably better before they get a lion's share of the money. So you would not spend so much money on Me Too, non-innovative products, and you'd try and take more efficiently, put more money into the products that represent greater therapeutic advances. And there's all these other considerations that you can read from the slide. Now, some of the ideas we have are to look at relative rather than absolute reward systems, so that you're not competing, you're not getting paid for some, it's not like the government says we will pay $10 for a life saved or something like that, or $10 million or whatever. One system is, if you have 20 new drugs in a year, they're competing against each other for a fixed amount of R&D money. So the budget constraint is the budget constraint. The government spends $57 billion. If there's one drug, he gets all $57 billion. If there's 57 drugs, they have to compete. So essentially, there's an incentive for companies to make ingenious arguments as to why their drug really deserves all the $57 billion. So you can harness their ingenuity in making, that's sort of an arbitration model. But we'd have to learn, but I think, as Tim has pointed out many times, good reward systems can be gamed by the giver and the receiver to move it in a socially productive way. There's different models for managing prize funds. The first thing people think about is the government, and it could be managed by the government, transparent criteria, and you could have commissions or experts or government employees, but you could also have insurance companies manage prize funds or nominate people for prize funds. You could require the funds for the prize fund to come from insurance companies. You could say a percentage of your insurance thing goes in. You could actually privatize the management of the prize fund. So if there was corruption, at least it wouldn't be government corruption. It would be a different kind of a problem. But you could essentially even break down the centralized nature. You could have multiple prize funds if you wanted. Now, what happens on this marketing situation? That's a big problem that drug companies have, is that they think that their marketing is actually not, the expression we heard in with Aventis was, it's not all bullshit. I think that was the phrase they used with us. They said there's some social value in what they do. So that raises some problems we're having to think about. Now, push. Actually, Tim and I prefer this. We just start with the prize fund because it looks like the patent system, sort of. You can even have the patent system and the prize fund, but this is different. And this is my last slide, my last model here. I won't go through the open because Tim talked about, but on competitive intermediaries, there's a coercive requirement that people contribute to R&D by the government. The government says that either through tax rebates or employees have to contribute or taxes themselves, that people have to contribute money to R&D. But in the competitive intermediary model, you get to choose who you give your money to, just like you choose the pension fund, which manages your pension money if it's a private pension. And so the idea is that the intermediaries don't do research. They're bodies that you give money to, and they fund research. And they try and do a good job. And if they do a crappy job, you have the freedom to give your money to somebody that you think performs better. So then there's some thinking about how far down you push the decision making. But the competitive intermediary model we find is interesting because it could support this sort of early type research, the kind of things that are more public goods oriented in research, the things that are including open research models and things like that, the more open collaborative models. This would provide an opportunity where if people thought that open research projects were better bet than a proprietary closed biotech model, money would flow one way or the other depending on what people believed was the most efficient way of buying innovation in healthcare. So consumers essentially in this model are buying, they're not allowed to be free riders, but they have freedom to choose who they give their money to buy and what business model and what style of development they think is in their interest in terms of health and creating health things. So we want competition, decentralization. Now this is our webpage. This is the end of my presentation. And We have a workshop, Tim and I do, at what, 1 o'clock, I think, Tim? At 1300, is that? I think we have a workshop on this R&D treaty idea later. Thank you.
Okay, before taking questions, I would like to state that I feel we have a very general political issue here that we need to discuss in the final discussion of this panel, because this is clearly not a technical issue anymore. It's about changing policies. So I would like you to ask questions that do not touch at that point of discussion.
Not touching on that point, I don't think. There's a thread that runs through both presentations and even the prior session, and it is related to peer review. And as we know, there's two forms of peer review. There's the kind that you do before you publish in order to filter out stuff that you can't rely on. It's a pre-public. And then there's peer review for research funding. And in a sense, you're introducing another form of not exactly peer review, but some sort of a reward system and a funding direction system. There, I think we get into a controversial area. I don't think that the flaws in expert judgments on quality evaluation of research are so great as to warrant redirecting the open access agenda in any way. But here, there are truly great flaws and blemishes in research grant assessment peer review, and you're going to inherit their burden. And I'm curious whether you have anything better to offer.
Well,
I would agree, there's lots of flaws in this. I don't know if I should quote this, but I talked to somebody at the NIH, or somebody who consults for the NIH, and I joked, you know, they doubled the budget. What did you get? Did you get maybe twice as much as the same research? He said, no, it's worse than that. You got four times as much of the worst research. One of the Wellcome Trust's angles of pushing for open access journals is they'll be able to better evaluate outputs. The moment we evaluate inputs, we have this slow procedure of awarding grants, which doesn't necessarily fund the right things, and it takes ages. And if you think of how the pharmaceutical industry works, you know, you make a pitch to a vice president, maybe you get £10 million the next day, maybe you don't. But if you do, then you can be sure that vice president will be breathing down your neck for the next 2 years to make sure that you actually deliver something. That's very close to what we did in the Human Genome Project. The Wellcome Trust gave us £100 million 2 days after Celera was formed to double our contribution to the genome. That's the way, you know, if you want to move things fast, you change the way that you do the evaluation, the allocation of funds, and the way you evaluate it.
What was the change? That you have some money bags that decides ex cathedra?
I think you can switch it round so there's more of that, you know, so there's more emphasis on, it's not a question of keeping your grant fund, of writing, you know, the danger is, if you can't evaluate outputs, what do people do? They try and look good instead, which is not the same thing. You know, you have scientists writing glossy presentations. You certainly see this in biotech, companies which try and sell themselves by looking good rather than actual quality of what they produce. Now, I think that if you want to make the system sustainable and more efficient, you've got to switch towards evaluating outputs. And we're not very good at that, but you know, I think we can become better at that.
If I can... I'm interested in models that don't rely upon peer review as allocators of money. The price system is an example of, it's not peer review, it's people, consumers buy things or don't buy things, and that's what drives investment. So whether everyone thinks, you know, all that's important is somebody is willing to take some risk and make some investments in something that they think might actually be utilized by people at the end of the day. Now, if you think of, for example, the prize model. If you have a prize model where the payoff is fairly transparent and predictable in terms of what, you know, what kind of outcomes will generate rewards. What's important is whether or not doctors will prescribe the drugs and patients will benefit from the drugs. And so if you think you can create a product, it doesn't make a difference whether your colleagues in the peer review process think it's a bad idea. If you're a contrarian and you can attract some venture capitalist, you have a crack at a big reward if the thing pays off. So it very much mimics, in many respects, the price system. It's what George Soros says, you replace the price system with the prize system. But you get the social benefits of marginal cost pricing, and you don't have the irrational and morally repugnant rationing of medicines. However, on these other models where you try and drive money down, the sort of competitive intermediary models, it's not necessarily a peer review process so much as empowering individual decision makers to choose against people that compete. And so we had this in our initial conversation. We said we'd create five competitive intermediaries in our very simple, I'll stop here, what would be, we just evaluate everybody after 4 years and fire everyone that worked for the least successful one. I mean, then we increasingly try to optimize our thinking about who would decide and things like that. So the question is, a peer review model is very much kind of a model familiar to academics. I come from economics, and so I sort of look at it as not what people's theory are about what they want, but at the end of the day, if they have the freedom, where will they put their money? And so we try and put the money in hands of people that would be able to, the freedom to pick different groups depending on how well they perform. I'd like to see Pfizer compete with Tim for people's money in kind of a more level playing field.
Okay, I feel we'll have a lively discussion in the end. There is one more question from the floor, and then I'd like to give to the next speaker.
I worked in a pharmaceutical companies as a post-doctor, as a medicinal chemist. So I know your activity, James, your activity is very interesting, and it should be very helpful to the healthcare. One more idea. Pharmaceutical companies, like if there is some very strange disease, very terrible disease like AIDS, they it's a chance for them to make money, to make a huge profit. So they are not interested in AIDS prevention. They are not interested in antivirus drugs or the so-called virucides, because genetically it changes very fast. And if we have the medicines, the price is down or freely accessible, and no patents right protection or patent rights from 20 years reduced to 5 years or even some other alternatives, then our government or insurance companies or the patients or all the people would like to put more emphasis on disease prevention, such as AIDS prevention, and antivirus to kill the virus. I think it should be possible, even though genetically it changes very rapidly and it is not interesting, it is extremely difficult, but we may find some way to develop many, many virucides, antivirus drugs to prevent it, to cure it, to not really treat and reduce the symptom.
I think that's absolutely right. If you look at the incentives in the patent system, it's primarily to treat chronic illnesses. The best cancer drugs are the ones like Gleevec, where they don't cure cancer, but they keep you alive for many, many years, so you can take it every year. That's the ideal drug for the company, and it's not the ideal drug for the patient. So I think that R&D is too important to say that it's the private domain of Pfizer and Merck and these companies, and they will just give them our wallets and our power of attorney and the deed to our houses, and don't ask any questions, and we'll get something back at the end of the day. That's the current model. It's because people are afraid to challenge even the fundamental, as you're describing, priority setting that takes place. Even there's no transparency of the research money itself. They're incredibly powerful people too. I mean, they, as you know. So that's why we have to mobilize. We have to fix this problem. We're not that stupid. We know we can do it better. And so if we continue to tolerate it, it's because we're lazy. We have to fix this problem.